What's your assets?
And how many of them?
We're going to open our Senate Education Committee today, the 11th of January. And before we get started, we have three new members since the last time we met, and would love to have them have an opportunity. I told Senator Benz to keep it under 15 minutes, but... 15. And that was mostly to keep Dembro under control. So with that, we'll start with Senator Dembro, who's new to this committee this session. He's been on education many times in the past. But Senator Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I represent Northeast and Southeast Portland, Senate District 23. Since coming over to the Senate, this is my first stint on education. When I was on the House side, I helped form the higher education. First, it was a subcommittee, and then it became a full committee, and it was higher education and workforce development. And it kind of aligned with my background because I was, yes, I'll say that in the past tense, although it's hard for me to, a faculty member at Portland Community College for close to 35 years. And I've spent time on the State Board of Education, have a real interest in the entire continuum of education and creating pathways to employment and to better lives. So I'm very pleased to be on this committee to engage with the full array of issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my district, of course, as many of you know, is Senator Farioli's old district, which stretches from Washington State down to California and then from Idaho to Black Butte Ranch. Lots of space. I'm very happy to be on this committee. I served on the AC school board back in Ontario for 3 years and on the St. Peter Catholic School Board for 6 years prior to that. And then years ago when in college applied to be the first student appointed to the State Board of Higher Education, came in second to someone with a master's degree from some school called U of O. Never really liked the U of O ever since, but whoever that was did a fine job, I'm sure.
He's probably somewhere in this body.
Probably is. But no, I'm looking forward very much to this the work this committee is going to be doing.
Thank you. And our other new member.
Oh, thank you. Chuck Thompson from Hood River, Clackamas, Multnomah counties. My wife's was a school teacher when we got married. She substituted for many years. My sister's a school teacher. My dad spent time on a school board back when I was a kid. I'm on the education subcommittee, so at least this way, being on this committee too, I'll be able to read one bill and take care of it in two committees, so it'll cut down on my reading time. Anyway, glad to be on.
So with that, thank you all for being here and being a part. It's been interesting having five-person committees and going to seven, which I'm more used to. The House had good-sized committees at different times, too, so it's kind of nice to have a wide group of people with varied backgrounds to have to dig into these issues. With that, we're going to open an informal hearing on re-engagement work group that's been going around the country, actually, trying to find out what's the best thing. So we'll invite up Representative Doherty, Bill Hansel, and Cord Bucher. Come on up, and we'll open that informational hearing. So whoever wants to start, Representative
I'll start
Doherty.
Out. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm the House representative from House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. The issue of reengaging out-of-school youth has been extremely important to me over the past year and throughout my entire career as both an educator and a legislator. It's no secret that we have more work to do in Oregon to ensure that every student is able to graduate from high school to a pathway of either college or career. To address this, we not only need to make sure that we're making critical investments in education that prevent disengagement of our students, we also need to make sure that there's a quality education opportunities for students who have left school so they can return, they can reengage, and ultimately complete their high school diploma or GED. That is why I introduced last session House Bill 6557 to convene stakeholders to develop a statewide plan to address re-engagement opportunities, which is different than some other things that we have within education and workforce. Since introducing the legislation and working with stakeholders here in Oregon and in other states, it's clear to me that Oregon must do more to serve this population of our youth. First and foremost, we have to create incentives to make sure districts are supported in serving students who require additional support to get graduation. That could be a fifth year or even sometimes even a sixth year to do that. And we have to make sure that we have equitable metrics to compare our alternative school programs so we can appropriately support programs that are serving these students. Washington State and Colorado are leading on serving out of school youth and disengaged youth, and I'm continuing to learn more and more about the work happening there and what we can introduce here in the state and implement here in the state of Oregon. I've been happy to work with the folks that you'll be hearing from today, and I'll turn it over to them and to explain some of the specific challenges and the opportunities that exist. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthica, members of the committee, my name is Bill Hansel, and I serve as a youth development policy analyst with the Youth Development Council.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthica, and members of the committee, my name is Cord Bucher. I'm the Workforce Policy Analyst for the Oregon Youth Development Council, and I will also be sharing some information with you today.
Shortly after House Bill 2657 didn't make it out of committee, because the YDC was named in that bill as a convener for some of the work to be done, the council decided to form an advisory group, a re-engagement advisory group, to continue the work outlined in that in the bill that Representative Doherty spoke of. In November, both Cord and I are on that advisory group as well. In November, Tacoma, Washington hosted the Western Regional Reengagement Plus convening, which was for Western states to come together to examine the best practices around reengagement. One of the excellent opportunities that it presented was to be able to examine and learn firsthand from the practitioners about Washington State's Open Doors program, which is the name for their re-engagement program that they started 7 years ago. And especially relevant to me is the similarities with Washington and Oregon in terms of population distribution, the effect of the Cascades on the state, and other things. So it is as similar to Oregon as any state in the nation, and to be able to learn something that is effective there probably has a high degree of possibility for Oregon. Additionally, Colorado was well represented as a Western state. And that is due to their re-engagement program that they instituted 7 years or 8 years ago, whereas Washington has started 7 years ago. And as part of our packet that we submitted, there are three other additional one-pagers that have more detailed information on these, and there is one specifically dealing with those programs in Colorado and Washington for your reference. One of the most important things that we found out about both of the programs in Colorado and Washington was their commitment to re-engage started everything. And over time, it became, in addition to a re-engagement system, a primary dropout prevention effort, because the robust options to re-engage also include robust options that prevent a youth student from leaving the system. So that was very unique. So what about Oregon? I'm using data from the 2011-12 cohort because until later this month, it will be the it's the most recent data for which the five-year calculations apply. So it gives us the full snapshot. Four-year graduates within that cohort would have graduated in the class of 2015. And what you'll see here is that when you look at graduates, which is the basis for our state rate, there is a significant number that do not graduate. Now, some of this population will have successful completer outcomes, which will be fifth-year graduates, four-year completers, or having earned a GED in 4 years, or 5 years. So this is just looking at and lumping together everyone who doesn't count as a four-year graduate, because that is what presents our graduation rate. When we break out those categories further, you can see the vast majority do graduate within 4 years. Approximately 1,300 complete, which is primarily earning a GED type option. Then at the four-year non-completer rate, which would be the equivalent of dropouts by and large, it's about 10,000 students. Over the course of the fifth year, we'll pick up about 1,700 that then graduate in the fifth year, and another approximately 500 students that earn an alternative, which leaves us with about 8,000 students per cohort that are not completing high school. And again, this would be a pretty good estimate for what we would call dropouts. Now, these youth can have left school at any point from ninth grade to 12th grade to be counted in this non-completer. So it's not like that 8,000 left at the end of their senior year or at the end of the fifth year. And the reason this is particularly relevant is that in order to hit a 90% graduation rate, which is what the governor has presented as a primary goal, and also our ESSA plan by 2025, it would require over 7,000 students to become four-year graduates. That's a significant number. And even if we allowed that all 3,627 students that successfully complete high school became four-year graduates, which is a sizable task in and of itself, that would still leave 3,000 plus students that need to be re-engaged or prevented from leaving. Effectively, that means that re-engagement is necessary to achieve the ambitious education goals that our state has set. Critically important to this as well is our equity lens. And when you look at the population of youth that don't complete high school, it is dramatically overrepresented by the categories of youth that the our equity lens is specifically designed to or intended to help. And oftentimes, because these youth are no longer students, they're not even looked at in the equity pool as applied to education. So in some sense, they've been removed from the denominator, if you will, or removed from this examination. And therefore, re-engagement becomes a highly equitable process, or it specifically helps to address equity issues because of the overrepresentation in that population. So any successful re-engagement will help our equity outcomes. With that, then, establishing the need for re-engagement, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Cord, who can speak more to Colorado and Washington. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, as we consider what a re-engagement policy and strategy in Oregon could look like, one thing we can do is refer to the effective and successful models in Colorado and Washington, and we've shared a few documents with you that cover that. One addresses the background on their policy and system development. Another talks about implementation and impact. And I'm going to share a little bit from the document on implementation and the impact that it's had in those states. Even though these systems were developed independently of each other, they share certain characteristics that seem to undergird that success. Several of these Representative Doherty already spoke to. The first is the strong commitment to re-engaging out-of-school youth that's supported by a statewide re-engagement policy. It's enshrined in legislation. There's system coordination and local community partnerships that align education, workforce, and human services. There are multiple options for youth to re-engage in the appropriate setting and services. The accountability for re-engagement and alternative education programs is tailored for the population they're serving. And re-engagement programs, as Bill Hansel mentioned, have expanded from not just focusing on dropout recovery to really becoming a preventative as more options are available for students. Let's see, and I think we've also – next slide, please. Perfect, thank you. Or back one. I don't know, I should switch it. So on to the next one. Thank you. So here are just quick summaries of where things stand now. So both of these efforts are about 5 years in. And in Colorado, there's widespread assistance to out-of-school youth to re-enroll and credit recovery within all Colorado high schools. There are now 92 state-approved alternative education campuses in 46 different districts, and the state has decreased the number of unrecovered dropouts. There's another outcome I'll touch more on in terms of their dropout recidivism rate, which is a unique accountability metric they developed in working with this population. In Washington, the Open Doors program has expanded to now 104 different sites. It's serving about 7,500 youth and young adults per year. And of that population, about 4,800 or 64% had made educational progress, graduated, or earned a credential last year. Next slide, please. Thanks. In terms of overall educational outcomes, we wanted to share the graduation rates as they've changed over this period of time in both states. And in Washington, they have a unique way of calculating dropouts. They actually have a cohort dropout rate, which is measuring within a four-year cohort in years 1, 2, 3, and 4, how many of those students drop out at any point. So it's a higher number than folks are used to seeing in a dropout rate, but it's a very accurate way to look at the dropout population in any high school cohort, and as you can see, it has steadily dropped. Next slide, please. And this was something I learned from talking with folks in Colorado. They have a dropout recidivism rate, so they don't just look at dropout rates, but they look at students who drop out more than once, because if a student drops out again, it's even less likely they'll be able to get them back. And when a student drops out, there's about, according to their data, about a third are going to be recovered. And so one of the things that they measure is this dropout recidivism rate, and what they found is that in their alternative education programs, there is a lower rate of repeat dropouts. And 81% of the youth who enroll in those alternative programs do not drop out of the alternative program. They either are retained, complete, or they return back to or transfer to another school. So those are all, we think, some really compelling outcomes that both states are seeing.
Thank you, Cord. The question becomes...
One question, oh. Yes. Senator Hess.
Thank you. Oregon has one of the leading absenteeism rates in the country, and I didn't see anything in Colorado, Washington to deal with that. And to me, I've always felt that, I mean, and nobody knows why we have such high absentee rates. There's probably lots of reasons, but nobody can really get the finger on what the problem is. I've always thought that Oregon's graduation rate problems, Oregon takes a bum rap for because of this absentee thing. You can't graduate kids from high school if they're not showing up for middle school. And so that's been a particularly thorny knot for us in this committee. We've looked at 1,000 different ways to measure it and track it and do all of these things. What suggestions might you have from looking at what these states have done to deal with that?
I'd be happy to handle that. Vice Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the question. In terms of re-engagement specifically, the absenteeism and the high rates of absenteeism almost always precede that event. And so it is a primary indicator for preventative efforts within the school system. And we really see that the chronic absenteeism as an indicator can best be addressed through the prevention efforts within the school themselves. And starting, you know, it's predictive at every grade level. And so it's not just related to high school. It's effective even in the lower grades. But it should serve as an indicator for concentrated efforts at the time of occurrence. However, once they become or leave school, the re-engagement, how that addresses chronic absenteeism or absenteeism rates is that the return looks to address issues specific to the individual student needs. And chronic absenteeism is not found to be the best indicator for re-engagement or alternative programs because it doesn't measure improvement in attendance. And what we find is that many students that are actually either successfully re-engaged or successfully advancing in their education in these alternative settings and showing steady improvement in attendance never even rise above being chronically absent. So we would want to look at improvement in attendance rate as opposed to chronic absenteeism in terms of how success for re-engagement is measured, and then really encourage the use of a chronic absenteeism measure as an early warning indicator to you know, focus within the context of what schools and districts are doing to prevent dropout.
Thanks.
Oregon is now primed to be the first state in the nation to create a system of re-engagement that incorporates both educational and workforce elements and serves youth up to 24 years of age. To accomplish this, Oregon must create policy that reflects a commitment to all youth. Youth is a critical word here because all students are youth, but not all youth are students. In similar fashion to policy that reflects the state's commitment made to prepare all children to be ready to learn in kindergarten through an early learning system, a commitment must be made to youth at the other end of the spectrum to prepare all youth for successful adulthood. A necessary first step in realizing a commitment to all youth is acknowledging that a population in need of re-engagement services exists. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, examining data from 2012 to 2016 in the American Community Survey, it estimates that Oregon has over 48,000 youth between the ages of 18 and 24 that have not obtained a high school degree or equivalency. Child Trends, analysis of the Census Bureau and PUMS microdata, estimates that Oregon has over 54,000 youth between the ages of 16 and 24 that are not in school and not working. Both of these estimates are consistent with the approximately 8,000 youth per cohort that do not complete high school within 5 years. So what are the next steps? As stated earlier, we can acknowledge the youth population in need of re-engagement services. These youth are not students, and preventative efforts designed for students do not impact out-of-school youth. We must commit to re-engagement as an effective, equitable strategy to increase graduation rates, increase completion rates, decrease dropout rates, decrease non-completion rates, and improve life out-course outcomes for all of Oregon's youth. And third, take action.
So we'd like to conclude by just offering a quick overview of some of the key aspects of effective re-engagement systems we've seen that could inform what we would build here. First of all, multiple options for youth. Non-traditional education settings should not be viewed as alternatives to failure, but rather alternative options for young people to achieve and succeed. The document Policy Considerations and Opportunities offers a variety of ways that completion of high school or high school equivalency might look for a re-engaged student population. Alignment between systems and agencies has been a critical factor in the success that other states have had in re-engaging and supporting re-engaged youth to educational success. Accountability and flexibility are also key. In both states that we've examined, there is a similar level of local control in their educational systems, and so they've been able to balance standards and oversight with locally developed and community-based solutions to dropout prevention and student re-engagement. And most importantly, the education that young people receive needs to be relevant and career-connected, particularly for older youth. And we've offered some examples of what that may look like in terms of both content and the types of settings that re-engagement could take place in. And so with that, we'd like to conclude this presentation and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I have a couple. Just going back to the numbers, that, you know, the 8,000 non-completers, does that account for students who might have left the state and graduated somewhere else? Are they brought into the mix? And let me ask you another question so you can answer them both at the same time. You know, we do have a number of students who drop out, and then several years later they kind of find themselves, or they reengage themselves if they're not reengaged, often through the community colleges. You know, do a GED and then go on to be successful there. Do we have a way to capture those numbers as well?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senator Dembrough, great question. And the answer is that this is based on adjusted cohort numbers. So the adjustment in the cohort is already removing from the denominator those youth that have transferred out of state, those youth that are deceased, any number of events that can be made to adjust for that cohort. So if they had moved out of state and Oregon Department of Ed received the proper, you know, information from the transferring district, they would be removed from the cohort. One of the reasons Oregon has very, very tough standards to be removed from the denominator, and these are not as tough. Other states don't have as rigorous definitions, and that can. That can impact why, or, you know, account for some of our low graduation rate, because there are youth that may be succeeding elsewhere but have just not had the proper documentation submitted.
So among those 88,000, there may be some who have been successful elsewhere?
Correct. It's possible that they didn't submit the proper transferring. A youth could have moved from Portland to Vancouver and be attending school there, and if they don't submit the required, the incoming district doesn't send the district that the student's leaving from the proper request, they don't get removed from.
And if I could add something, when the longitudinal data system is up, which should be, you know, look at our watches and see it, that is also the information that they might be able to track with other states and other entities. And so a few years down the road, or even less than that, we might have more of that kind of information available to us quicker.
Additionally, that 8,000 number does include students that a more precise accounting at the individual level. I'm using aggregate data, but there, if we looked at it individually, it would make sense to remove. This isn't a significant number. It would be, for example, severely medically dependent youth, institutionalized youth. It would be, that number would be lowered, but it's not as significant. You know, you could probably, like I said, use 8,000 and have those youth accounted for in that, in the 152 that you're taking off. But that's just a ballpark guess.
And those who might reengage via the community colleges down the road, are those tracked? So, I mean, if someone subsequently gets a GED, you know, let's say 10 years later, then goes on and maybe gets future degrees or whatever, because I think that has to be one of our goals here, to mm-hmm. see that happen more. Can we get credit for that, in a sense?
Yeah, I think, as Representative Doherty said, the longitudinal data system could begin to show us these longer-term mm-hmm. outcomes. In Colorado and Washington, they do track sixth and seventh year graduation and completion now, so they can see a little bit longer out within their educational data if a student graduates or completes beyond the 4 or 5 year rate.
Other questions for this group? I guess what I would end with saying is that my intention, as I've watched this group go to other states and look, and with Representative Doherty, is that we will have another hearing during the regular session to have some more information about this. And then third, to get a work group going like I've done in the interim to see if there's deals. Because in the long run, and when you talk about student success or you talk about any of the graduation rates, we have to account for them or we'll never get to the goals we have. And this may be, if we do it right and if we learn from others, the low-hanging fruit we're looking for to increase graduation rates. I mean, if we can reengage those people at the right time, if we can get them to stay, this may be that youth group that can make a big difference in graduation rates if we do it right. So I will keep you informed and find mm-hmm. out if there are people who are interested in being involved in that group.
Well, and I think in conclusion, and it was alluded to, is that between Colorado and Washington, we've got great information. We've got great ideas. There's best practices that they've used. And I think what it is from the legislative, and the state already wants to make the commitment, but I think from a legislative angle, to really make the commitment to fund and to look at these programs will, I think I can confidently say, will help the dropout rate that we have. And the idea of even going to absenteeism all the way down to kindergarten is where we start looking at those things. But it's like the framework's there, the best practices are there, we just need to have the will, we just need to have the way.
Mr. Chair, can I just add one thing? And that is, you know, I appreciate the reference to career-oriented mm-hmm. Focuses, to relevant and career-oriented, because I think that, our growing reinvestment in career technical education, I think, is really critical here. And that is a difference between us and Washington. Washington never really disinvested in career technical the way that we did. And I think they have benefited from it, frankly, in keeping students engaged and in school.
Okay. Thank you.
And along that line, we have very talented staff. So they looked up attendance rates in all three of those states. And Colorado is better than us. and they have a better graduation rate. Washington is worse than us in attendance, but have a better graduation rate. So it could be connected to some of the same kinds of things, and it's probably worth looking at, because I have always felt I would agree with Senator Haas that the absentee rate, especially our chronic absentee, is a good connector to who graduates. Those kids that don't attend school much, especially the chronic ones, don't generally make it through high school. Yes, Bill.
Chair Roblin, and I think that makes perfect sense of what, and if you look at re-engagement in the larger picture, just like a student needs to be in school or not chronically absent, attending to benefit from education, students need to be, youth need to be students to benefit from all the initiatives that we have ongoing right now and all of the opportunities Measure 98 presents, all of the state plans that we have to address these things that in order for them to maximize, be maximally effective, it helps to get youth back to being students. At that point, the educational system can do what it does and increase, those numbers will increase because now there are more students.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close that informational hearing and open an informational hearing, an ODE update, and we'll have a short introduction of Colt Gill again, and our report card redesign. So Colt and John, come on up. Thanks for being here, Colt.
Right, good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colt Gill, Acting Deputy Superintendent of the Public Instruction here in Oregon. And I'm here this afternoon to share information on the department's work on the redesign of our school report card system. Joining me is John Weens, our Director of Accountability and Reporting, who will provide information on the technical aspects of the report card. But first, I do want to take just a couple of minutes to reintroduce myself to you, particularly in this new role with the department. So over the last 28 years, I've had the opportunity to serve as a teacher, an education technology director in a school district, a principal, a curriculum director, an assistant superintendent, and a superintendent for 10 years at Bethel School District, and then for the last year as Governor Brown's education innovation officer out of the chief education office. So I feel privileged to lead the department at this time and partner with you all in our effort to improve outcomes for Oregon's children and youth. I'm driven by this work and can't think of really any other task that's more important to the future of the individual students we serve or to the state of Oregon. Having been a leader in school systems for many years, I understand the Oregon Department of Education's critical role as partners both to you and to school districts and communities in guiding teaching, learning, and assessment, but also to guarding civil rights, financing our schools, and ensuring transportation is provided, providing healthy meals and wraparound services, and much more. The department's pretty comprehensive. And we add to that mission a new set of significant directives that Governor Brown has released. The directives include two overarching principles. One is ensuring that we go about our efforts with a high standard of accountability and implementation and a strong alignment and consistency to our equity lens. These directives call for me to work closely with other education agency directors and the governor's office to establish a unified budget for education that highlights collaboration across early learning to college and career. Specifically, she's also asked that at the department we embed equity and culturally responsive practices across all of our programs and initiatives, that we collaborate with the Early Learning System Director and the Early Learning Division in the development of a new statewide early learning plan that's inclusive of a strong pre-kindergarten to third grade transition system, that we improve outcomes for traditionally underserved students through both our statewide equity initiatives, the African American Black Student Success, the American Indian Alaska Native Plan, the English Language Learner Plan, and new efforts to improve high school success through Measure 98 and the chronic absenteeism reduction efforts. Also to identify and scale up promising practices that foster state, regional, and local partnerships to improve graduation outcomes. To integrate dropout prevention strategies and re-engage youth partnership with the Youth Development Division that you just heard about, and with the partnership with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Also to assist efforts to fulfill culturally responsive educator professional development goals through direct collaboration with the Council on Educator Advancement through Senate Bill 182 that was passed last session. And finally, to partner with our STEM hubs, regional achievement collaboratives, ESDs, districts, partner agencies to better align our workforce needs with career-connected learning in our schools, community colleges, and universities. So you can be assured that ODE staff will work in close collaboration with the legislature here, the State Board of Education, our communities and tribal partners, as well as across state agencies within ODE's offices to achieve these directives. My aim is to partner with all these entities to work together to meet the needs of our diverse students that we serve today. Our state, our schools need to succeed, and the entire generation of students that are currently attending our schools are counting on us to deliver. So on behalf of myself and our staff at ODE, I look forward to working with you to improve the outcomes for all of our children and students in our state. With that, I'm going to move on to provide you an update with the department's work on the report card redesign. The state is in the process of implementing Oregon's state plan for the Federal Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA. As a part of the new law, Oregon has the opportunity to redesign Oregon's school and district report cards. ODE first produced report cards in the year 2000 and has revised these several times over the years. The current report cards are data dense. I don't know if you've looked at one recently. We will flash one on the screen for you. They have limited graphics. These features make them less accessible than they could be to the families that we serve. ESSA provides us with a great opportunity to take the next step in design improvement for our reports and to make them a little bit more relevant to families, especially families in marginalized or historically underserved communities. The redesign project has the following goals. So the first is to design a report card that is more accessible and meaningful to our families and students, and especially those families, again, from historically underserved communities. The second is to take a two-stage approach to this. So one is to create a one-page front and back at-a-glance report designed specifically for families. And second, to supplement that at-a-glance report with a web-based dashboard that contains additional detailed but still understandable data on our schools, including all of the data required by current law. So now I'm going to now turn it over to John Weens, and he will provide you with more details on this.
Okay. So Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, members of the committee, I'm John Weens. I'm the Director of Accountability and Reporting at the Department of Education. And I'm here to just give you an outline of the process that we're using to redesign our report cards and some of the things that we've accomplished to date. So some of this Colt already discussed. Again, our plan is to create a two-page report designed specifically for parents, especially parents from underserved communities, to help foster engagement between parents in their schools. This will be supplemented by, as Colt said, by a detailed report that will contain lots and lots of data. We often struggle to show fewer than 1,000 data elements per school, to be honest. The full requirements of the federal law are massive, and they're really more than I think the ordinary parent probably wants to see, at first glance at least. So here's an example of our current report cards. These were redesigned in 2012. This actually was a vast improvement, I think, over earlier designs. But you can see from the example here that although it contains a lot of really good data, it's pretty dense. There's a lot of text. And I'm not sure that you would say that this invites a parent to read it. Other states have done things similar to what we're trying to do here, which is to create a two-pager that really draws the families and parents into the report, makes them want to read it more than our current design. So here's an example from Illinois just to show you what is possible, things that can be done differently. So here's a design that's heavy on graphics, not as much text as we see before on our current example. And the hope is that in a design like this, parents and families are more likely to want to read this sort of report than our current report. And so with now sort of an idea of what is possible, here's the timeline we're using for this process. It's fairly condensed. In September and October, we did stakeholder outreach. That included a statewide survey, but more importantly, we did 11 parent focus groups where we went out to communities and met with parents and asked them questions about report card design and content. In November, we analyzed those results. We prepared reports of the stakeholder engagement, which we can make available to you, and we presented our results of that engagement to the State Board of Education. Since then, we've been building prototypes. We just started a second round of parent engagement where we're showing prototypes to parents and asking them which features they like and which they don't. We're hoping by March to finalize the at-a-glance two-page report so that we can begin producing it for October. It takes a lot of time to produce these things. And so if we can get the design by March, then we'll easily be able to make the October deadline. So our goal is to have the next state report card include this two-pager. So regarding the outreach efforts, we asked some questions of parents. In particular, what's important for you to know about your school? What's important to a parent may be different than what's important to an educator or to a member of the Department of Education. What does a parent and family-friendly report card look like? What is something that you're more likely to read? And how can we ensure that this report card is valuable to you? We got a lot of good feedback. As I said, we did a statewide survey. It was open for 2 months. We put it out in English and Spanish. We asked very similar questions. We did get almost 600 responses. But with a survey like this, you typically get educators, frankly, to respond. So a majority of the respondents were educators. We did get some a fair amount of people who responded as parents. And that gave us enough data to get some distinction between what parents and educators seem interested in. But really the focus of our work is working with the parent focus groups. And I said we did 11 in the first round, and we really were trying to reach parents of historically underserved communities. So you can see a list of some of the groups that we went to. We met with Spanish-speaking parents, American Indian, Alaska Native parents of American Indian, Alaska Native students. We went to the Black Parenting Initiative in Portland, migrant, rural, and low income. We met with a group interested in students with disabilities and their needs, and we also visited a charter school. So we tried to reach out to a number of different parent communities, especially those that we thought may have not had as strong a voice in the system as others. So we learned a few things. I must say not all of these were surprising, but we got really good authentic feedback, I think, from these parent groups. They want, first and foremost, something that's simple, multicolored, and easy to read, and easy to understand. No education jargon. They also really want to know, and this is where you see the parent perspective especially. They want to see information that talks about how the school creates a safe and welcoming environment, not only for the students, but also for the parents as well. And they want a report card that talks about growth and progress. So as I've said, we've taken these themes. We have more detail behind these as well. We've taken these themes, we're developing prototypes that we're doing for a second round of engagement with parents and other groups. And so this shows you our upcoming schedule. We did show some prototypes to our external ESSA advisory committee. That's been an external stakeholder group that's been helping us throughout the development and implementation of the ESSA plan. And I said we were also going back to parent and family focus groups. Hope to finalize the design in March, present it to the state board for their approval, and then the work begins to implement and produce the reports for October. We mentioned earlier that we plan on doing an online data dashboard. That is likely, well, we know that's going to take a bit longer to produce. Perhaps by October of 2019, although that may be a bit optimistic, but eventually we're hoping to produce, to move away from, more away from the paper-based reports that we have and move to more of an online reporting system. And that's all I have. So if the committee has any questions, we'd welcome them.
Any questions? Yes,
Senator. It's not a question so much as a comment. Would you mind updating the OLIS document that shows this PowerPoint, because your Illinois example is missing from that OLIS document?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Thank you. The dashboard, the only thing that concerns me about it, is it going to be a dashboard about general school district, whatever, not down to the student data? Or if it's going down to student data, how does a parent get an access code so that it won't be shared?
This is different from parent view or some right. other system where parents can access their own student records. This is about aggregate school level data. And we'll start out with the data that's required by law, aggregate data on assessments, on attendance, on graduation, but done in a more interactive and graphical format than we have now. Okay. So it's not intended to be student level. Okay. It will not be student level.
That makes me feel much better. Any other questions? Thank you for the update. And both the federal government and the state government change so often, it's really, I know, a burden on you guys to try to come up with the next iteration of whatever it is we're asking for. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll close our informational hearing on the ODE update. We'll open an informational hearing on and the introduction of our new TSPC Executive Director. Come on up. And we've had to do this a little more often than we anticipated. So it was about a year ago that we met our last TSPC Director. So thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Anthony Rosilas. I am the current, 8 days in now, Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and I am grateful for the opportunity to be here with you today, share a little bit about myself, a little bit about where I would like to see TSPC move in the future, but also remind the group, and as a good starting point, of the key responsibilities of TSPC. The Teacher Standards and Practices Commission has three primary goals and responsibilities. First is to assure that quality educators are entering the field, and we do this through maintaining rigorous and appropriate licensing standards and rules. Second, we assure the positive professional practices of educators by maintaining and enforcing high standards of performance. And third, and possibly the one I actually not possibly for sure the one area I am most interested in with is communicating standards for educator preparation and accrediting quality educator preparation programs that meet the needs of today's and tomorrow's students. And I start with those three key responsibilities because it leads me to my interest in this position. I'm a non-traditional educator. I came out of law school in 94, hoping to be a tree hugger lawyer here in Oregon, ergo why I took the Oregon State Bar. At the same time in California, I was married and had a son on the way, and quickly realized that I could make more money and help raise a family a little bit more securely as a teacher than at that time as an attorney for a public interest group. Nonetheless, I took the bar in Oregon, and that has served me well through my career. I started as a substitute teacher. My first full day in the classroom was on an emergency credential in the state of California, where at that time you could come out with a bachelor's degree, technically, and be put into a classroom to teach students without any teacher pedagogy behind you. And even in some cases, as it was widely publicized in California at the time, sometimes questionable content knowledge. So I got to experience teaching from the most introductory level, wishing that I had quality preparation behind me and doing that work. Well, that combined, I think, with my legal experience and legal education, led me real quickly into support work on an administrative side. I became an elementary assistant principal in California. Then I was recruited by Beaverton School District to serve as administrator for classified personnel for a few years. And then I moved back to UCLA, where I got my bachelor's and my law degree. And I was a faculty advisor for 2 years in their teacher education program, where at that time we were piloting, and I was on the team that was preparing and doing review of what was called the Performance Assessment for California Teachers. That has important relevance to what we do here in Oregon, because that group consisted of University of California schools, Stanford University schools, and the development of that PACT assessment later led to the development and evolution of what we know in Oregon as EdTPA, which is the performance assessments we use for pedagogy competency in Oregon. I moved to Illinois to take on a role working as an assistant superintendent for instruction and human resources in an Illinois school district, again, another state that at the time was going through redesign and educator preparation. I moved back to California to take a superintendency. I was a superintendent of about a 3,200 student elementary district in Riverside County, where I got to experience at the same time the role of providing quality education also with an area that was in high demand for good quality teachers. Most recently, I was at Klamath Community College, where I served as vice president for student and personnel services and the legal counsel for KCC. And KCC was a wonderful opportunity because it allowed me to do the work of education and legal work, but to do it in an environment that was at the forefront of a lot of the good things that this legislature has actually done. Most recently and best known probably is the bill to eliminate or greatly reduce the problems of transferring credits from community colleges over to the public universities. KCC is also a rural environment where we got to serve the populations of Klamath and Lake counties. And it really made me appreciate the work and the role of educators and what we do at all our levels. So coming to this position, I find that it's a perfect blend of my experiences, my education, and my interests. So where do I see TSPC going in the future? And, of course, working with the commission and the legislature to help evolve TSPC to meet the continuing and evolving needs of our students. We need to continue to partner with other agencies to provide comprehensive, timely, and quality services to school districts, educators, and educator preparation programs. Personally, my goal is to continue and even increase the collaboration of TSPC staff with the commissioners, with the legislature, other state agencies, districts, parents, educators, and the greater community to reduce redundancies that are often found amongst the state where we have 5 education agencies, to assure the continuum of learning for educators, and assure that our educator preparation programs continue to evolve to meet the needs of diverse students in an ever-changing world. To increase the educator diversity of cultural and linguistic diversity of our educators within the state. And this must start as early as middle school, in my experience, in working with bolstering the value and importance of being an educator, which is often forgotten about. We often in our schools encourage students to become lawyers, doctors, engineers, professionals. We can do more to encourage our students from a very young age to recognize the value of that person that's in front of them helping them in reading, writing, arithmetic, science, and social studies and whatnot. We have 39% approximately of students of cultural and linguistic diversity in Oregon, while we're still hovering about 10 to 11% of our educators of cultural or linguistic diversity. The governor has stated that she believes that's inappropriate. I think this legislature has stated that before. I definitely personally believe that is a problem for our state. So in all areas of diversity, I think TSPC plays a great role in working to help support, recruit, train, prepare, and retain educators of color, linguistic diversity, diversity of disabilities, and diversity of thought. And finally, to support the transition to the National Standards for Education Preparation Programs, while also balancing those national standards with the particular needs we have in Oregon. Oregon is a state that's very unique, and we should be proud of that unique expectations we have for public education, for ourselves, and for also what we hope to see as the future for our students and citizens of Oregon. And in any national standards movement, much as the legislature probably dealt with in the Department of Ed, dealt with, for instance, moving to the Common Core state standards, we know that in addition to those standards, we have very high expectations for what we accomplish in the state of Oregon. And likewise, with education preparation programs, we also need to recognize that balance of a national standards system with the needs of our evolving population and desires for Oregon. And with that, I look forward to the opportunity to partner with the other agencies in the state, with the legislature, with these the committees such as your committee, Senator Roblin and Vice Chair Linthicum, and the entire legislature and the governor's office to help evolve education to where we know we want it to be and where it needs to be for the benefit of our students. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you coming. Fairly short notice, but you've only been here a little while, so it was hard to get a hold of you a long time ago. We thank you for that, and we anticipate seeing you from time to time as this committee continues. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
So we'll close that informational hearing, and we will open an informational hearing on Future Connect. Emma Calvo, yeah, there you are. How long do we think this one's going to take? Because we've got another person that has a meeting issue, and we've got a work session we have to do.
We can be fast.
Okay. Go fairly quickly.
Pretty quickly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Linthicum and members of the Education Committee for this opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Mark Mitsui. I'm the president of Portland Community College. And PCC is Oregon's largest higher education institution. We serve approximately 80,000 students annually. Also, with nearly 7,000 dual credit students, we serve as the largest high school in the state as well. At the end of the 2016 session, you gave the Higher Education Coordinating Commission continued funding for college completion programs in Oregon. And that funding meant a continued commitment to Future Connect, and today we're here to share some of the program's recent successes. Before I turn it over to our talented staff, I'd like to say a special thank you to our legislative fiscal office and higher education champions in the building, such as yourselves, who work to protect programs like Future Connect. And now I'd like to turn it over to Josh Laurie, our Future Connect director, to explain why this program is so successful.
Good afternoon, Senator Roblin, Chair Roblin, and
you can move
members
the mic.
Of the committee.
It's easy. Just then you can sit comfortably.
I always tell the students, don't move the mic too close.
Yeah.
My name is Joshua Lorry. For the record, I'm the program manager of Future Connect at Portland Community College. I will make this quick. I would like to thank you all for your support in House Bill 3063. At the end of the session of 2016, we were able to utilize funds to support upwards of 480 students in our region. We serve students in Portland, Beaverton, Hillsborough, and now Columbia County. Some of the most salient data points from some Education Northwest report that we did from that funding are here on the handout that you have in front of you. And two things that we noticed that actually surprised us were who our students actually were in Future Connect and how they're actually doing. So from about 850 surveys and data from three cohort years, we were able to find that students were coming to us with both 88% free and reduced lunch background in the K-12 system. One in four had some or experienced current food insecurity in their first year of college, and one in six were currently experiencing housing insecurity. This was a surprise to us. Our program serves first-generation low-income students and students who aren't generally thinking about college in their senior year, but we didn't realize this is what we were up against in our community. If you turn it on the backside, you can see a quick chart that shows a little bit of how our students are doing to comparable zip codes, students from comparable zip codes in areas of first-year GPA, first-year credits earned, and fall-to-fall persistence, as well as completion or transfer within 3 years. And one thing that I think is particularly interesting that stands out here is that our students of color within Future Connect are outperforming our non-students of color who are in those programs. So on some level, we are actually removing a lot of the achievement gap when students come to college. And as a program manager, I'm quite proud of that. With that work is done really by our coaches. And the whole crux of Future Connect is done by a coach who meets the student and provides kind of a one-stop shop in terms of advising, financial literacy, and as well as onboarding at the college system. So I'm going to introduce Suzanne Hesse, who is our college success coach at Southeast Campus.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Suzanne Hesse, and as Josh said, I am a college success coach with the Future Connect program at the Southeast Campus. My role as a college success coach is incredibly rewarding and extremely unique to the work that I've done in higher education over the last 13 years, mostly in instruction. I feel like the college success coach role takes a few different hats. Number one is helping the students navigate the often confusing and complicated college system. We meet with our students as soon as they're accepted into the program. We go out to the high schools, and we speak to them a little bit more about what the program's going to look like and what the few months before they start college will actually look like. Then, over the course of the summer months, we hold orientations for these students, not only to get information about the college itself, but also to meet other students within their cohort so that they can begin building relationships not only with the coach, but also with their peers and fellow students who are about to start the same journey that they are about to go on as well. Beyond the summer orientations, our students come in and meet with us one-on-one over the summer to do things like placement and to make sure that their financial aid is complete and ready to go, to discuss their career and academic goals and what the options are at PCC. And those are vast, and many of our students don't recognize or realize all the different paths that are open to them. After kind of that navigating system, coaches also are instructors. We teach two courses over the course of the year, College Success, which is CG100, and then also a Today's Careers class, which is CG130. Those are taught in the fall and winter. And while those are partly about teaching, it's also about continuing to build that relationship with our students. It's important that we, as their coach, see them not only inside the classroom, but also outside the classroom, because that's where the relationships really happen. I was a reading and writing instructor for 12 years before I became a college success coach. I would have my students for maybe 3 months, and I might see one or two of them again, but I'd never seen the majority of them again. The relationships I'm building with my students now are long-term. I have a feeling that they will be in my life, and I will be in their lives for quite some time. As a college success coach, we also support the students with their transfer goals, if that is something that they're interested in, or helping them apply for our Associate of Applied Science programs like dental hygiene, which you're about to hear about, or nursing, or some of our certificate programs as well. We also help them have access to internships. Most of them are paid internships that could put them on a career path. We guide them to leadership opportunities, both within our program, coming back as leaders at our orientations for the following summer for our new students, also taking a leadership class, and then potentially working in leadership positions on our campuses so that they are not only students, but they feel as though PCC is really their place. And beyond that, we also support our students with community resources, helping them with food or housing insecurity as those things come up. If there's employment issues, we can help them find jobs. And then also just to be the person that is there to be their support, their champion. If they're having a bad day, a rough class, or something goes really well, they come to us to talk to us about that. And that is really what I find most valuable about my role as a college success coach, is the relationships that I'm building with my students. And I'm going to hand it off to one of my students now, Jorge, to tell you a little bit about what it's like being a Future Connect student.
Good afternoon, Chair Senator Roblin and committee members. I am Jorge Trujeque, resident of Portland. And I'm just going to talk about how the Future Connect program has helped me be a better person and a better student throughout the first year and now second year of college. Walking into the Future Connect program was great. It was a great opportunity having people to support me throughout my college experience and to guide me through, you know, the rough road. And Suzanne has done a really great job at that. She's not only a coach, but she's like someone you can go up to, and you know she's always going to be there with whatever you need. They guide you through pretty much everything. And I came from Gresham High School not knowing what to expect from college. I'm a first-generation college student, first to graduate high school, and also low income. And college is just a really rewarding experience. The Future Connect has opened so many doors for me, like introduced me to new people and just grow as a student. And also, I got an opportunity to be a leader at the school and also guide other students in the correct places.
So, questions for this panel? I guess my question to...
Oh, yes. Senator Hess.
Thank you. Future Connect is such a great success. I wish we could replicate it at all the community colleges. Could you refresh us? I hate to bring up the tawdry subject of money, but could you refresh us on the funding model and how it works and where the money comes from?
So there's a just over $3 million allocation added to the base for the community colleges that will be distributed through the HEC and the CCWD on a competitive grant process. And the guidelines and components of it are, I'm biased, but I'll say that they're very, very related to Future Connect. And so each community college has an opportunity then to fashion an initiative for their college.
Could you remember to state your name again every time you talk?
I'm sorry, Mark Mitsui, for the record, president of Portland Community College.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks. And Portland gets more because of the population and size, obviously. So who are the participants in that $3 million, that fund, who contributes?
Any community college in our system can apply for those funds.
And who are the contributors?
The funding comes from the general fund as part of our base, and then but it is administered like a competitive grant process, is my understanding.
there's outside money that comes in the future.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm mixing.
I think that's the key. That feels like the key ingredients, like the sugar and the cake.
Okay, yes, Mr. Revenue.
For the Portland Community College Future Connect model, separate from the state completion funding, yes, we do get money from the city of Hillsborough, from Beaverton, from the city of Portland.
And now Columbia County.
And now Columbia County as well. They contribute to the scholarship foundation. And then we also get philanthropic donations.
Mm-hmm. And I, Mr. Chair, I think that's a very important part of this, that the results are pretty well quantified in Future Connect. And that's, that's kind of a new thing for a higher education to get outside philanthropy, helping community colleges, not just local governments, but outside people. And I would just like to see more Future Connects in LeGrand or Tillamook, around the state.
That's a great point, Josh.
And Chair Roblin and members of the committee, one of the pieces that we used from 3063 2 years ago was to bring all of the community colleges together for 3 convenings to talk about best practices, because we know what we do in our area isn't always going to fit the same needs of more rural communities. So we were able to kind of create some synergy between all the community colleges around the state, and we're hopeful to do that again.
Mr. Chair, yep. It's just so necessary, and if you look at the philanthropy to universities compared to community colleges, it's astronomically out of proportion. It's like 100-1 or something like that. But the results, Future Pact speak for themselves.
Yes, Mark Mitsui again, President of Portland Community College. But we do hear that from our donors, that they appreciate the accountability. They appreciate the fact that it's a public-private partnership, and they appreciate the stories that they're hearing from the students that undergird all of this.
Okay, speaking of that, we'll go to Ontario. And
yes.
Ontario. And Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear, and I don't see in the materials, the numbers of students helped. And I have a follow-up to that, but how many?
Chair Roblin, Senator Benz, excellent question. So far, we've served 1,975 students, and we typically serve about 50 students from any one community, so 50 in Beaverton, 50 in Hillsborough, about 220 in Portland, 10 in Columbia County, and then with state dollars, we're able to broaden that to other. So our cohort typically ranges anywhere from about 340 to 400 each fall.
And follow up, Mr. Yep. Chair, the question would be how many folks are acting as helpers, as guidance counselors, as
It's about 1 to 120 ratio. So we have 9 coaches.
And the question for the coach is if you could give some advice to the high school that our excellent witness went to, so that he didn't have to burden you as much with asking for help. What would you tell that high school?
Chair Roblin, Senator Benz, first, I don't think I would classify a burden. I love the work that I do with my students. And Jorge was actually also part of a College Possible program at Gresham High School. We have an outreach coordinator who goes out to the high schools starting in September, and she works with the counselors out there as well. I believe that we're getting pretty fantastic support from most of the counselors in college centers within the area to help the students not only necessarily apply for the Future Connect program, but also to offer financial aid nights. So our outreach coordinator goes out to talk about Future Connect, but also goes out to talk about FAFSA and help students do that as well. So the high schools are doing quite a bit, I think, the ones that know about our program. That might be a question for Jorge, actually. What would have been more helpful? Do you feel like your College Possible coach helped you with the program?
Yeah, College Possible helped a lot.
So more programs like that or another outreach coordinator for us?
We can follow up. Yes. So I just recall I was so upset with the lack of counseling at the high school that I attended, I went back to it. And after I'd been in college for a number of years, and I actually spoke to the 3 or 4 graduating classes, telling them to go get counseling, and because I was irked. And I did the same thing, oddly enough, when I left law school. I went back to law school 3 years later and said, you people are not doing your job well enough. And so I'm just asking you how we can better talk to high schools so that the excellent work you are now doing perhaps is not as necessary. And if you're saying that that's already been fulfilled by virtue of those folks you've sent out into that space, yay. But we're here asking, or I'm here asking.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's really beneficial about the coach role and what I do as opposed for my students as opposed to what a student who's not part of our program experiences when they come to PCC, a student might come in not part of our program and they'll attend the orientation center and then they'll go talk to advising and then they'll go talk to financial aid and then they might talk to student records. Our students just come to us. I'm not in the high schools as much, so I don't know if there's like one point counselor for each student or if they have groups, but because my cohort of students, I have 105, I believe, on my caseload right now, they all come to me. So if the high school counselors are having, I know for a fact my students, my children are going to be going to David Douglas. I don't know if that's possible for one counselor to be meeting with only 100 students. But that, to me, is a doable ratio. I have my new cohort of students is just over 50. It's not, you know, easy for me to meet with all 50, but it's doable for me to meet with every single student, to talk with them, meet with them, know what their goals are, not only in college but beyond, what struggles they have in the community or at home or with other things that are problematic for them that could become a barrier for them in college. But it's really that kind of one to however many ratio that's super helpful. And I don't know what that looks like in a high school because I haven't been in high school in a while. I don't know if that answers your question.
That's close enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, just following up on those questions, you know, one, I've been a strong supporter of Future Connect from the beginning, and I remember actually the very first cohort, there was a gathering of the cohort when they were still high school students at Portland State University, if I remember right, and because Portland State was a partner then, and one of the questions I'll have is, you know, are there ongoing partnerships with higher ed? With universities, but you know, that sense of identity of this group when they were still high school students, so excited about being part of this cohort, and you know, looking that they were future college students at that point, it was very, very powerful. And you know, I do think that the pathway aspect of it, and to the degree that you really are creating a sense of a college-going culture among students while they're still in high school, really is an important part. And I hope that that is being nurtured, as is the entire sort of pathway. You know, as they once, you know, when they're in college, I mean, I think the real strength of it when they're at the community college is that sense of being part of a family. Mm-hmm. You know, the mutual support and identity, you know, with others. You know, we've seen, you know, in the colleges, we see a much higher graduation rate among the professional technical students, because once they're in a program, they have that sense of identity and close contact with instructors and peer support. But then in terms of transfer, you know, for those who are transferring to the next step, I'm just wondering, is that still in existence? And, you know, is Portland State contributing to this program, for example? Or, you know, I know that the college has transfer opportunities with the private colleges, you know, the Lewis and Clarks, the Reeds, you know, et cetera. Are they also kind of see themselves as part of this pipeline and helping financially to support it? If not, I would suggest that.
Senator Dembro, Chair Roblin, you're speaking my language. I love this. This is what we do. We have MOUs now with PSU and Lewis and Clark College. So Lewis and Clark College 5-4-Y's for students who complete our program. That's a big deal. We have agreements with Pacific University, 3 full rides every year for students who complete our program. PSU is unlimited, last dollar amount for tuition, books, and fees. They started out with 25. We sent them 35. We sent them 65 last year. And this year, we're hoping to send them 85. So those are our transfer students. So those agreements are there. And now we're working with OSU to develop agreements as well. So we're working with where our students are going, and the idea is both reaching down into the K-12 system and providing transfer relationships for students to the 4-year when it's there.
Chair Roblin, Senator Dembrough, you mentioned current technical education, and it did, you know, Future Connect started with a transfer pathway. We've also started a parallel Connect program called Workforce Connect. This is for the current technical education students as well. So using the same principle and also partnering with philanthropic donors, we're developing a workforce pathway as well.
Thank you. And I would just say finally that, you know, when I look back to that first gathering at Portland State, you know, students are so excited. But I have to say it was their family members that were really excited there. They were so proud and really saw this vision for the future for their children and siblings.
Other questions? Always appreciate students coming to share their story. Good luck with your future and all those other kind of stuff and all the things you choose and your dreams that you have. So, again, thanks for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
And with that, thank you. We'll try to make sure that we get this message out, because I agree with all the people who asked questions and Senator Hass in particular about we need all of our community colleges to get into some of these programs and to start developing those relationships with the donor class out there that can help them. It may be harder in some places, and if they've never tried, it may be a lot easier than they think, in large part because of the successes you have already shown. And a lot of people want to get engaged in helping people meet these kinds of expectations. So thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll close that informational hearing. We have three bills that the committee can elect to draft. So we're going to go through those a little bit, just informational, so you'll know what they are. And in particular, the first one, there were a lot of people that came to us with this omnibus bill. And so we're going to invite up for an informational hearing on LC7, our omnibus bill, Hannah Lai and Richard Dillon. I had to let him sit back down before I got him up again. So. Though they are not the only people, well, Hannah is the only person that really knows all of it. There's a lot to this bill, and it kept growing a while. So
now ready you for it?
So, whatever you want to share with us.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, my name is Hannah Lai. I'm Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. I'm responsible for drafting these 55 pages, so I would love to be brief, but... Well, I'll just do what I can. So this omnibus bill has 11 major sections to it, and I'm just going to start going down and let me know if you have any questions. So the first part involves sections 1-4. This involves licensure by Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Last session, you passed Senate Bill 205, which created a 90-day grace period for teachers to be in the classroom without a license if they had a application that was pending and they'd passed the criminal records check. This LC7 extends that to all licensees of the TSPC. So the main categories you'd be picking up would be like administrators and school counselors. In Senate Bill 205, we also removed the expedited process for granting licenses. Decided we really wanted that back. So the words that we took out last session, we've pretty much put right back in, a few tweaks and updating the language. So that's the first section. Section 2, or the second part of this, is sections 5-11, and that involves public charter schools. What that involves is that in 2011, you passed legislation that authorized institutions of higher education to become a sponsor of a public charter school, but that the ability to become a sponsor was limited. And in 2017, as an institution of higher education can no longer become a sponsor. But we do have language in the statutes that address what would have happened if they had become a sponsor, because they could have become one. The window when they could have become one was limited, but they could have been one indefinitely once they were one. But there weren't any institutions that took you up on it, so we don't have any institutions that are sponsors. We never will, but we still have the language about institutions that are sponsors. So these sections 5-11 take out any references to institutions of higher education. The third part is sections 12 through 13. This involves HEC reporting requirements. With all the work with the higher ed, we found out that there were some redundancies. There was a work group formed after Senate Bill 113 in the 2015 session. They came up with some suggestions. These sections incorporate those suggestions. The fourth section, fourth part, is section 14 that involves kindergarten. Comes to us from Mr. Donovan here. Right now, the statute says that a school district must offer half-day kindergarten and may offer full-day kindergarten. And the concern was, if a school district is offering a full-day kindergarten, can someone come and insist that they provide half-day kindergarten as well? Arguably, that is the case. So what we are clarifying is that if a school district is already providing full-day kindergarten, they do not also have to provide the half-day kindergarten. Any comments?
Richard Donovan, on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association, that's correct.
Thank you, Richard. The fifth part involves the Educator Advancement Council, and this is one area that when you talk about draft or error, I will omit this is what did happen. Last session, we passed Senate Bill 182, and that had some complex elements to involving educator networks. Inadvertently had made the small print version of a statute effective immediately, which meant that the Educator Advancement Council became part of the Department of Ed instead of the Chief Education Office. Office, as was always the intent. So the changes that we have going on in these sections are to match what you thought you did last year, basically. You may see some bold that looks like it's substantive. It's nothing new. It's exactly what we had passed in the 2017 session. So there's nothing new. It's just basically making your intent law, as we wanted to do in the first place. The sixth part is sections 18 through 24. This involves certain students that we considered residents for the purposes of receiving state school funds. There is a provision that allows foreign exchange students who live in dormitories that are owned and operated by school districts to be counted as residents. There's currently a sunset on that. The sunset is July 1, 2018. The LC would extend it to July 1, 2020. I do want to point out that when you look at those sections, it looks like we're playing with open enrollment. We are not. There's nothing at all involved in open enrollment in this. The reason that you're going to see some bolding and bracketing involving open enrollment is just because it's in the same section and it also has a sunset. And so to make everything line up, we had to address that. But there's nothing substantive involving open enrollment in this bill.
Can I ask a question, Mr.
There's
Chair?
Another bill.
This is like Groundhog Day this week.
Yes.
Is there a point in time at which we will just either make this permanent or make it go away rather than every 2 years pushing the sunset out further? Because we've been sunsetting it for over a decade.
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
Yes, we have. Well, the point would be, Mr. Chair, when the schools that do this come together with a better solution. And that hasn't happened. And Senator Farioli promised it would 6 years ago, years, and that's how we get here.
And I will make a commitment to start looking at that. I wasn't involved with Farioli when he was doing it. I will try to figure out if there's a better way to do this, because I agree that, and I think it's an appropriate, personally, I'm okay with it, but I think there would be a better way to do it than what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, my only point is, I think it's a lot of,
yes.
Like, if we're going to do it and we're going to continue extending it, it's a lot of anxiety for
yes.
everyone to kind of hurry
I
up
agree.
And get it moved. And if it was intended to spur a conversation because it was going to go away, just the pattern that we are in of always renewing
right.
it perhaps took that urgency away. So maybe that means we've decided just to make it permanent, or if not, we should be clear.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I agree. Understand that.
Okay. No, I was just going to add the same thing. You know, I remember asking this question a few years ago and was given a good answer, but which I don't remember, you know, as to why we keep doing this. So, you know, I think Senator Hass's reason may be the best.
Well,
I remember Representative Huffman being really involved
yes.
in being the champion of this, and now that he's gone, Somebody's going to have to take it on,
right.
I think.
And I will have to look at it.
It's probably not, today is not the time to have that discussion, but once we have that discussion, I think a lot of people in other schools who are subsidizing this would say, wait a minute.
Right.
Are you kidding me? And when you look at the cost per student for some of these small districts who need extra help, but whether it's this much extra help, it's a really interesting policy question that really makes you wonder that, if there isn't a more effective way to better serve the state and better serve those schools.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, going on down the list. The seventh part is Section 25, and that involves the approval of educator preparation programs. In 2015, we decided to enact a requirement that educator preparation programs must be nationally accredited as of July 1, 2022, and that date has been extended by 3 years to July 1, 2025. Next one part is sections 26 through 27 that addresses the National Board Certification Fund. That's a fund that's available to help teachers become nationally certified. And this LC clarifies that only teachers who are licensed in the state and working in the state are eligible to receive money from those funds. The next part is sections 28 through 29 involving virtual public charter schools. Those schools are prohibited from having employees of for-profit entities with one exception. That exception is administrators. The exception is scheduled to sunset July 1, 2018. This would remove the sunset and make those that exception permanent.
I know.
The 10th part is sections 30 and 31, and this involves there's a requirement that school districts must provide certain students lunches free of charge. Those school districts can then seek reimbursement from the Department of Ed, and this is saying that the department must go forth and find other monies if they don't have enough to reimburse the school districts for all monies that they are seeking reimbursement for. And the final category is sections 32 and 34. And this is relating to the beginning teacher and administrator mentorship program. Right now, the types of licensees that are eligible to participate in that program and receive related grant funds is limited. So what we've done is expanded the types of licenses that are eligible to participate so more teachers can participate and administrators. And those are your 11 parts.
And thank you, Senator Lithicum, for being a part of working with on that one. Because as most people know, we get three bills. At least one of them has to be a jointly between the two of us. And, this is the one we picked. I think there maybe the others would be equally there. But any questions with regard to all of this? And we'll let you know more. And recognize that it's going to be introduced, and then we'll go from there.
Right, yeah. And this is something I'm sure that will come up, but just for information purposes, the extension of the, what was it, the national certification to 2025?
Yes.
Why is that?
That came about because of a couple of the universities that are trying to get there that they weren't going to be able to make the deadline, and so they asked for us to have the conversation. I don't know, I can't tell you all the exact reasons, but that was the basic premise behind it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nicely done. We'll close our informational hearing on LC7. And I see that our people from HEC are here, so we're going to open an informational hearing on House Bill 2701. Just an update. So, Kyle, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Senator Roblin, members of the committee, and welcome, Senator Benz, Senator Demereaux. My name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative Policy Affairs for the HEC, and I'm here today to give you an overview on some of the activities that HEC has been engaged in with the Private Career School Advisory Committee as a result of an agreement we made with the Senate Education Committee with the passage of last year's House Bill 2701. So just first a little bit of a quick recap on the history of the bill, especially for the benefit of members that weren't here during the debate. This was first heard in the House Higher Education Committee, and when it was introduced, it required HEC to prevail at an administrative hearing before we were to place a private career school on probation. And I put on the slide the meaning of probation, which means it's a formal notification by the commission that we have identified some deficiencies in the operations of a private career school that need to be corrected. And so the important thing to note about that definition is probation in and of itself is not a sanction that placed a prohibition on the right or the privilege of a school to operate. And so initially when that draft came out, HEC sought a few amendments to that proposal. And so we provided legislators some information regarding the entire warning and sanctions process that we use across different private institution types. And that information is posted on OLIS under the original House bill. If you'd like to take a look at that, there was a flow chart that described the differences between private career schools and Office of Degree Authorization schools. We discussed the duplication that would occur if HEC essentially had to notify a school that it intended to issue them a letter and then had to prevail at an administrative hearing to simply gain the right to issue that school a letter. That issue was thoroughly discussed during the House session or during the House debate. And then we discussed the need to maintain more informal routes of handling issues that are more minor in nature that pop up in the operation of private career schools. It was felt that the more formalized and the more arduous those initial routes of notification became, it would be more likely that HEC would essentially proceed to more severe routes of sanction, including suspension or revocation of a school's license. So the final bill that was passed by the Legislative Assembly incorporated some of that feedback and incorporated some of the feedback from one of the private career schools that participated in the debate. And the final House bill made three changes to our investigations and sanctions process. First, it required HEC to notify and engage with schools subject to a complaint that is being investigated. It's the engagement requirement that is new. Previously, HEC had the authority to investigate, but the statute itself was silent on the need for engagement. Now, proper investigative practice implies that HEC was doing that sort of engagement anyway, but the committee elected to codify that necessity into the statute. The second change that was made in the final bill is that the term probation was changed to notice for corrective action. And that's a bit of a recognition that probation was in and of itself not a penalty, and probation has a connotation to it that perhaps is not intended. So the term notice for corrective action describes, I think, much more completely what is the actual step HEC is taking. That is issuing a letter to an institution identifying certain deficiencies. And third, the final bill requires HEC to stay a suspension or a revocation of a license if an institution had requested an adjudicated hearing, which was, again, an issue that HEC did in practice but was absent from the statute. So now that it's in the statute, a future director of private post-secondary, a future HEC commission, must afford an institution that right. Also related but not in House Bill 2701, House Bill 2457 contained a provision that exempts materials related to an ongoing investigation from the need to disclose under public records law. There had been an issue previously where members of the media caught wind of an investigation HEC was conducting, and HEC did not have the authority under public information law to withhold any of that information from the media. And clearly that can have the effect of causing a negative reputational effect on an institution that has not been found to have committed any violation of state law. So now, during the ongoing investigations phase, we have the authority to keep those materials from the public. The determinations we make are still subject to public disclosure. So that all sounds pretty straightforward, but in exchange for some of the modifications that House Bill 2701 makes, we also made an agreement with Senator Roblin and this committee, and that agreement is kind of described on this slide. So House Bill 2701 does not actually take effect until July 1 of 2018, and in the meantime, the committee requested that HEC convene an advisory group to determine if there were any other possible changes that could be made to the investigations and sanctions statutes. I think if I can kind of describe what I felt the goal of this agreement and what the goal the committee had for the HEC was, was the committee only heard from one private career school, and it only heard from the commission. And there was this desire to explore this issue further using some sort of stakeholder group to determine if there were any other more broad-based changes that institutions felt could be made. And so in achieving the goal of that agreement, we utilized the expertise that's on an advisory panel that we already have constituted. So we use the Private Career School Advisory Committee, and that statement that's on top of the list of names there is a statement that's slightly modified that's on our HEC website. And you'll see the membership list. It's predominantly school members. There are members of the public. There are two current vacant public member slots. And the reason we elected to use this group is, well, obviously, one, it's already constituted, and two, it generally, the private career schools as a community generally respect the fact that this is the process that we have for working through these kinds of issues collaboratively with their community. And so we felt that constituting a separate stakeholder group in this instance might kind of violate that norm that we have with them. So this group is very collaborative, as a matter of fact. They meet quarterly. HEC Private Career School, basically the entire private career school staff sits in with the committee, and they engage in 3-4 hour meetings approximately once every 3 months. And we treat this relatively publicly, even though it's not necessarily subject to public records law. We record the meeting. We take minutes. We post those minutes on our website. We blast those minutes out to every private career school in the state of Oregon so that they're pretty well aware of the issues that are being discussed. And so this is the general process that we used. We kicked this off in September of 2017. I and Sean Pollock, who was doing some related rulemaking on these types of issues, sat with the Private Career School Advisory Committee, and we provided them a summary of House Bill 2701 and explained the agreement that we've just discussed. We heard introductory thoughts and answered questions, and we provided a little bit of informational material, and I'm going to skip ahead for a second. I'll come back to this slide so you have an opportunity to read it. The two things that we did provide them in that discussion were the same flowchart that you received, which talks about all of the different types of sanctions that exist currently in the private career school realm, but also the realm of degree authorization schools, which are also private schools, but they're private schools that are authorized to issue degrees in the state of Oregon versus private career schools, which traditionally issue certificates or other completion credentials, sometimes gauged towards passing licensure exams and things of that nature. We also provided them a summary of the HEC investigation and sanction processes as they would be altered by House Bill 2701. So we gave them a really complete picture. Well, if you do nothing, this is what the state of play will be as of July 1, 2018. So if you want to make changes to that, that became the baseline document that we discussed. So just jumping back really quickly, we had a solicitation period where we sent information out to all of the private career schools in the state. We gave them approximately 1 month to issue any comments that they had regarding any changes that they thought the PCS Advisory Committee should discuss. So we sent that first communication mid-October. We sent a follow-up communication the 1st of November. And we ended the solicitation process on November 15th, after which we did our research on the one submission that we did receive, and we sent that submission in its entirety unaltered to members of the advisory committee. And on December 15th, we had the concluding conversation with the advisory committee. During the course of that conversation, the one submitter was provided 15 minutes at the top of the meeting to explain their proposal and its three constituent parts, and I'll tell you what those are in a second. And then we engaged in a debate for about 90 minutes in which the submitter, even though they're not on the private career school advisory committee, was welcome to participate in that discussion and that debate. So very, very briefly, these are the changes that HEC did receive as part of this process. So we received a request to eliminate the ability for HEC to initiate an investigation on its own motion. We received a request to require an adjudicated hearing prior to issuing a notice for corrective action, which was the subject of the original House bill. And we also received a request to define what engagement means in ORS 345-120. And this was essentially the conclusion. So after the course of that debate and over the course of hearing about this issue for the span of about 3 months, committee members recognized the passion of the presenting school. They certainly asked questions that were aimed at better defining HEC's interpretation of statute and administrative rule. There was a significant discussion about whether or not notice for corrective action was a proper term to use. I think generally members felt that it was kind of technical sounding, and you know, should we use warning letter or a couple other suggestions around that type. But ultimately, at the end of the discussion, the committee unanimously declined to endorse any further changes to HEC's investigation statutes. However, they unanimously committed to close observation of how we implement not only the changes that were made from House Bill 2701, but how we more broadly implement our responsibilities with the potential of revisiting their recommendation in the future. So that's the conclusion of my comments. If I can just kind of editorialize a little bit, I think they show that there's relatively general agreement across the community that, one, obviously there is a necessity that there be a regulatory process in place, even if that process sometimes has negative implications for the schools themselves, but that the schools themselves are relatively comfortable that there is an appropriate balance with HEC authority versus the right and privilege and need for the schools to operate relatively freely.
Any questions? Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, I didn't follow this issue closely last year, but I do, you know, I do want to say, you know, I was obviously involved in the design of the HEC and the decision to bring the different agencies that, or the different offices that oversaw private career schools. One was in OSAC, one was in the Department of Ed, and then there was higher ed, and just bringing them together for a kind of coordinated oversight. And I think that that has been one of the real successes of the HEC, you know, is that sort of, you know, coordinated activity. And this sounds like a, you know, a symptom of that success, actually.
Senator Roblin, Senator Dembro, I think symptom is a good word for it, and there is more alignment between, say, how ODA and PCS schools are treated now than perhaps there used to be. But I would encourage you to look at the document that's posted on OLIS under the original House bill, where you see these tiers of sanction, and there is still differences. But I should point out that neither community is requesting that there be alignment between them. They're different communities, and so we do treat them slightly differently because of that.
Any other questions? And thanks for coming back with the report that we wanted to have you come back with. And thanks for sharing with us the process you went through.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll close that informational hearing on House Bill 2701. And we'll open an informational hearing on LC90, Resident Open Enrollment, Morgan Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators to continue tilting at one of my favorite windmills, the topic of student transfers in Oregon. And LC90 is a very simple bill. It extends the sunset date for open enrollment, which is currently at July 1st, 2019, to July 1st, 2020. And in practical terms, that means that open enrollment would be extended one more school year, the 2019-20 school year. And just as a reminder, you extended it 2 years in 2016. And I do want to make clear that this bill has nothing to do with student transfers related to charter schools or virtual charter schools or the other four pathways that have to do with student transfers. But I think, as you know, that since the legislature passed open enrollment in 2011, we've had a bill almost every session to deal with issues that keep cropping up around student transfers and significantly change the interdistrict transfer process. We've talked about tuition, and we've had many discussions. And I think it's safe to say there's never going to be 100% agreement on the best way for students to transfer in Oregon. But what I can say confidently is that my conversations with stakeholders who share different perspectives lead me to believe that we're much closer, perhaps, than we've ever been on the dream, which is to have one type of pathway or one system for students to transfer. Right now we have six, if you throw in the charters and virtual charters. And essentially it gets very complicated. It's confusing for students and families. It's complicated for school districts to administer. And so by extending the deadline 1 year, what our hope is that in the interim that we can come into the 2019 session and have a bill that sort of streamlines the whole thing. We've been very close before, but, you know, we've let our differences get in the way, and it's become a little bit partisan over time. But we've had a lot of conversations, Mr. Chair, and you and I have talked to people, and I think we're very close to convening people, and we need that extra time to do that. And Senator Haas and Senator Gelser encapsulated the debate. You know, it's like, well, do we just take the sunset off and just let it go, or do we take one more shot at trying to come up with something that probably works better for families and students and schools? And I know people share a different perspective. If there's a way to come to an agreement in February, I'm certainly willing to do that. I've talked to other stakeholders that I think have very good ideas. I don't think it's impossible that we could do it this February, but where I sit right now, I still think the best thing to do would give us the time to bring people together. So we'd ask you to adopt the bill and move forward. Thank you.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan, I'm sorry, but I'm really concerned if we extend the sunset and we then all come to an agreement and solve the problem, will you still talk to me? Like, what will we have to talk about? And then what will we do with the legislature all day?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gelser, absolutely, I'll still talk to you. You know, my windmill's not as big as, say, you know, revenue reform or campaign finance, but it's still my windmill, and there's plenty to still talk about.
So. And follow up?
Yes.
What about Hannah? Will there still be enough work for Hannah?
Well, and the good thing, I did not say, Mr. Chair and Senator Gelser, I did not say, since we drafted it, we think we might need to do one more little actually, this is true. I'm not joking. We might need a little clarification in the bill to make sure that there's no ambiguity about when the sunset would end and stop open enrollment. But in all seriousness, I really think we're very close.
Other questions? Thank you for that clarification. Okay. Thank you, Morgan.
Thank you.
We'll drop that one. And now we'll take the most controversial one, LC-91. And we'll have who's coming up? Cindy's coming up.
We'll do this quickly.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Cindy Hunt, Acting Chief of Staff of the Oregon Department of Ed. As long as it's the most controversial one, it's last on the list. Okay. So a little bit of background about why you have LC-91 in front of you. So last session you passed Senate Bill 20, and part of Senate Bill 20 addressed modified diplomas. At the heart of Senate Bill 20, we are trying to be in compliance with ESSA, which had just passed. After that, the department heard from many constituencies about concerns relating to modified diplomas, including parents, administrators, teachers, etc. And the main concern, well, there was many concerns, but the primary concern was that students who received modified diplomas would no longer qualify to continue to receive services up until age 21. So based on these concerns, the department, and I want to honor our partnership with COSA, OEA, OSBA, and legislative staff, started working on a solution back in September. And we had several goals, but the three primary goals was kids continue to get education, we continue to get federal funds, and we don't disrupt students' education, specifically in 17-18 school year. So the first thing that happened after that was the state board adopted a temporary rule, and that grandfathered in kids, so it took care of 17-18 and allowed us time to come before you with LC-91. The other thing that happened during that time period, it also bought us a little time, right, is that the U.S. Department of Ed started communicating with other states that had multiple diplomas. Oregon only has three diplomas. Lots of other states have, you know, 7-8 diplomas, such as Indiana, right? And Indiana's grumpy about this, by the way. So, because they're being told that they can only have a couple of diplomas for purposes of the graduation rate. And so we also worked with national partners around, you know, what can we do to achieve our goals? And so what we settled on based on all that communication was that essentially for Oregon's purposes to meet ESSA, we are going to count our standard diploma and modified diploma for purposes of our graduation rate. And then under ESSA, we're allowed to count an alternative diploma. We don't think that's quite the extended diploma, but we've never counted the extended diploma towards our graduation rate, so that will not have an effect. And then what LC91 does is it rolls back the law to pre-Senate Bill 20. So a student who receives a modified diploma will continue to have a right to receive an education until age 21 or until they receive a standard diploma. And it has an emergency clause, so it would go into effect almost immediately. And then it would take the place of the state board's rule, basically. We also want to thank Senator Gelser, who convened a stakeholder group of, I don't know, I was on the phone. I think there was at least 30 people in that room on this topic, you know, and helped us, you know, communicate out to parents and stakeholders and students about what was going on. And as soon as that meeting occurred, everything just kind of settled down. And that's where we are today.
And for some people that may not understand, there is a real need for a number of our special needs students to have transition services for that extra time to get them in place to be self-sufficient, to have work and all those things. And that's what this preserves, really. Sarah, any comments? Thank you for the convening the group.
No, just thank you to everybody that worked on it. And that group, I think, is what predicted my fear about the open enrollment. We had all these people in a room, and everybody agreed. And I think it was Morgan that said, this is really confusing.
So, any questions? Thank you very much, Cindy. So we'll close that. And now we have to open a work session on LC 7, 90, and 91. So we'll open that work session because, as part of, everybody knows, we have to introduce these bills in a committee. That's what we're going to do now. And I like to make sure that I tell people ahead of time, your agreement to introduce these bills has no indication whether you like them, dislike them, like part of them, like other parts of them. It is only to introduce them, and your actions after they are introduced are entirely up to you and do not have any reflection on what you do in the next few moments doing this. So with that, Senator Lithicum.
Mr. Chair, would you like them lumped together?
Might as well, unless there's any. Yeah, I would think it would be great.
Okay. I will do that. I'd like to make a motion for the following three LCs to be introduced as committee bills. LC7, dated 1/10/18. LC90, dated 12/19/17, and LC91, dated 12/21/17. Those are the three LCs to become committee bills.
So Senator Lithicum has moved that we introduce as committee bills LC7, dated 1/10/18, LC90, dated 12/19/17, and LC91, dated 12/21/17. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the introduction? Seeing none, so ordered. And with that, is there any other comments that people want to make to this bill? Seeing none, we are adjourned.